طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجر، من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. And this is your host, John Roberts. The entire broadcast this morning consists of a presentation by Phyllis Bennis, a Middle East scholar, author, journalist, and activist. She is currently a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She gave this lecture a year ago at the Allworth Center for Peace and Justice at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, Minnesota. And it is relevant to this day because it is such a succinct review of the history of Israel-Palestine, which is rarely heard in the United States, because it is from a Palestinian perspective, corroborated by a host of historians who have written since the opening of the Israeli military archives in the early 1980s to scholars and journalists. When we introduce This Week in Palestine each week, we promise to deliver the Palestinian narrative. And that is exactly what Phyllis Bennis does in this historic review of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Thank you all, and good evening. It's great to be here. I was telling Tom I was in Duluth once before, when I was very young, to go canoeing at the Boundary Waters canoe area, and then somebody who was clearly determined to remind me how I'm not young anymore reminded me that when I was here, it wasn't even yet the Boundary Waters canoe area protected. So thanks a lot, gang. That's all I got to say. I want to thank the Allworth Center for Peace and Justice. I love the idea that it's an academic center called something about peace and justice, and not only about conflict resolution, which is sometimes the soft version of it. Peace and justice is what's important. So thank you for all of that. You know, it's a little hard to see here. There's a lot of people here. How many of you think that the Israel-Palestine conflict is the most complicated political issue in the world today? I see hands. I see half-hearted hands that are not quite sure, but let's go with a lot of you do. And it makes sense, because the way it's presented to us is in some ways designed, I think, to make it sound very, very complicated. If you strip out some of the complications, it's actually not as complicated as you would think, because ultimately it's about people's rights, it's about human rights, and it's about land. That's what a lot of political struggles in many parts of the world are all about. But when you start putting forward ideas for solutions that are grounded not in human rights and equality for all, but are grounded in issues of religion and power and money and not justice and international law and equality, it starts to become very, very complicated, because you realize that people come to it with very different assumptions of rights. Whose rights? Whose rights are more important than other people's rights? This becomes a very tricky business. So for the last 25 years, we've had what's known as the peace process, right? That's the familiar term, the peace process. The peace process is, one, organized by the United States; two, based on the idea of the two-state solution with swaps. You have to say that very fast, because it's like all one word. the two-state solution with swaps. It used to be just the two-state solution, but that became kind of impossible, so then it became the two-state solution with swaps. And everybody knows becomes the theme. Everybody knows that when there is a peace agreement, the major settlement blocks will belong to Israel. Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that a Palestinian state will not have control of its own borders, will not have control of its own airspace, will not have control of its own telecommunications, will not have control, really, of anything. Everyone knows that. Except the problem is the Palestinians don't really know that because nobody ever really asked them. So we have this problem of this goal that is supposedly what everybody knows is the goal, and we just have to figure out how to get there. But it's a goal that doesn't match the realities of people's lives on the ground. So if we take a step back, or take a few steps back, and say, well, let's look at the question of the role of the United States. Why is our government so central to what happens thousands of miles away on the other side of the earth? Why is the U.S. the one that gets to decide what's the basis for a peace process, who gets to come to the table, what's the shape of the table? We pretty much decide everything. Why is that? For that, we go back to the origins of the State of Israel. The U.S. was a supporter of the creation of the State of Israel from the beginning, as were a number of other countries. And it supported Israel in a way that was seen as relatively normal. Israel didn't get most of its weapons from the United States. It got most of them, this was in the pre-state and the early state period. It got most of its weapons from France and Czechoslovakia. It didn't get most of its money from the U.S. There was some, there was actually quite a bit, but it wasn't what we now call the special relationship. That didn't happen until the 1967 war. So what happened in 1967? You have this small country that was created by the United Nations, that the U.S. had supported, the Soviet Union had supported, Europe had supported, that had become a global movement, in a sense, or reflected a global movement in the context of the Holocaust. Because those Jews who survived the Holocaust, or who had managed to escape as the Holocaust took shape across Europe, no longer had homes to return to. They were now a people without a country, a people without a land in many cases. Rather than figuring out a way for those people to be able to go back to their own countries, or to go where they actually wanted to go in most cases, which was to the United States, where their families were, or to the UK, which was the sort of second choice, the question of the establishment of a Jewish state in historic Palestine, which had been on the agenda for 50 years or so by then, but had never been a majority opinion, either among Jews or among anybody else. It was always a minority opinion, the creation of a Jewish state in another people's land. But suddenly, after the Holocaust, it became the only solution because, to a large degree, our own government's combination of anti-Semitism and anti-communism prevented huge numbers of Jews who wanted to come to the U.S. after the war, after the Holocaust. They were not allowed to come. They were not allowed to come. You know the stories of the ships that were sent back. And those people who were trying to get to the U.S. after having escaped from the most horrific of crimes were told the one place you can go where you will be welcome is to this new Jewish state that's being created in Palestine. So people went, and it became the dominant majority view, certainly among the Jewish community in the U.S., but also among U.S. officials, again, motivated in many cases by the combination of anti-Semitism and a few others, who didn't want large numbers of Jews coming to the U.S. So this was a way to divert them somewhere else. Let some other country take them, have them. We don't want them here. because anti-Semitism was a cold, harsh reality in those years. So the state gets created, and it's a small state, but suddenly in 1967, Israel goes to war, and the first thing it does is to wipe out the air forces of both Egypt and Syria, and then in 6 days, it conquers a whole bunch of land and triumphs over, as the mythology goes, 6 Arab armies. Now, there weren't, in fact, 6 Arab armies that actually fought. There were 6 Arab armies on paper. In the real world, there were about 2. But nonetheless, it was a huge military victory. And the Pentagon looked at this and said, wow, these guys are good. We could do business with these people. And military business became kind of the core enterprise of the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. So all of a sudden, this small state now includes not only the 78% of historic Palestine, which Israel had occupied following its what it calls the War of Independence, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, when they lost their land. 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes, from their land, in the 1947-48 war. The UN, which had created the idea of dividing Palestine into 2 states, an Arab state and a Jewish state, had given 55% of the land for a Jewish state, despite the fact that the Jews at that time were only 30% of the population and owned only 6% of the land. The Palestinians were 70% of the population, but they were given only 45% of the land. And by the time the war was over, the Israelis, the new state, had not 55% of the land, but 78% of the land. Only 22% was left. The West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. In 1967, following the war, Israel now controlled 100% of that land. It now controlled the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. It also controlled the Syrian Golan Heights and the Egyptian Sinai Peninsula. So that was the beginning of this special relationship with the United States. And that led to, remember the times, we're talking 1967, we're in the middle of the Cold War, and the U.S. is competing with the Soviet Union for influence all over the world, and particularly in the Middle East, where issues of oil and strategic reach are all very important, right? So the Pentagon suddenly realizes they can build this strong, tough relationship with this new state and build on a relationship which movements in the United States, movements to support the creation of an Israeli state and then to build a stronger relationship with the Israeli state, those movements, mainly in the Jewish community, the movements that we now call Christian Zionism, didn't really exist in very organized form yet, but in the Jewish community, that became a very powerful movement. It didn't have that much influence until the Pentagon said, yeah, we like this. We can do business with these people. And from then on, the combination of this lobby, this pro-Israel lobby, and the strategic advantage that the Pentagon and the State Department and the White House saw led to the consolidation of this incredibly close set of ties that were economic and political and diplomatic, and in every way, the U.S. became the superpower supporter of Israel. And Israel took on a very important role in the Cold War. These were, you know, the Cold War, of course, was not very cold in a lot of parts of the world, in Africa, in Latin America, and elsewhere. The wars were very hot. And in many of those wars, Israel emerged as the cat's paw of U.S. military interest around the world. So whether it was in Guatemala in the 50s when the Guatemalan military was slaughtering native people in the highlands, and it became so kind of politically untenable for the U.S. to keep supporting this Guatemalan dictatorship, they asked the Israelis, and the Israelis immediately said, sure, no problem, we will become the arms exporter to Guatemala. And the Israeli Galil rifle became the weapon of choice in Guatemala in that period. You had those examples all over the world, in Africa, in Angola, in Mozambique, in all these places. And you had this now a three-part U.S. policy in the region that was one part about Israel, one part about oil, and one part about strategic positioning, the ability to go to war anywhere in the world pretty much. You could, if you're in the Middle East and you have bases and support in the Middle East, you can go to war against Africa, you can go to war against Asia, you can go to war against Europe. You're in the center of everything. And all of that was important. So why was it that Israel, emerging in this Arab environment, becomes this Western enclave? Well, it turns out that that was actually the goal of the people who created the idea of a political Zionist movement. Very different from the religious call, you know, and for those of us who grow up Jewish, we grow up learning a prayer that says, next year in Jerusalem. And the Zionist movement that started at the end of the 1900s, it was in the 19th century, around the 1890s, Theodor Herzl, who's known as the founder of modern Zionism, he wrote about what this Jewish state would be like. And he was very clear, this is not about religion. This is not about realizing the religious claim to the land. That is not the basis of this state. This state is going to be a secular state. And in fact, in his diaries, not so much in his famous book, The Jewish State, but in his diaries, he included the letters that he had written to Cecil Rhodes, the great British colonialist, urging Rhodes to support his project. He wanted Rhodes to be his backer and to persuade the British crown to support, as they ultimately did, the creation of a Jewish state in what was then British-controlled Palestine. That was what led to the famous letter of in 1917. So he writes to Rhodes and he says, why am I asking you? You're interested in Africa and I'm interested in this little piece of Arabia. You're concerned about Englishmen. I'm concerned about Jews. So why am I coming to you? Why am I asking you for help? And then he says, he comes to the crux of it, because our projects are both something colonial. And I remember reading that after spending my life as a very strong supporter of Israel from the time I was a little kid right up through high school, and saying, whoa, nobody ever told me that part. And yet, it made perfect sense that that was how Israel came to become this huge partner of the United States, as a part of a colonial-style movement around the world. So that's not something new. So if we go back more recently, the last 25 years, where we have this peace process, it's all based on the idea that the U.S. is the legitimate power that's supposed to determine what happens. Now, and nobody really questions that. Nobody says, wait a minute, who elected you guys? You don't live here. Why do you get to say how many states there should be? One state, two state, red state, blue state. Why is this your business, right? So I think that's where we can start. You look at people, some of these guys like Dennis Ross and Aaron David Miller, are these familiar names? Do I see yes? Nods? If you listen to public radio, for instance, or watch mainstream news shows, these are the guys who are always being brought on as the commentators. What's happening in the Israel-Palestine peace process? And their credential? I was one of the negotiators for 25 years, and you want to say to them, yeah, how's that going for you? You know, 25 years of failure, and these guys are still the ones they keep calling to come and be the commentators. You know, you'd think at some point somebody would say, you know, maybe we need somebody else to have a sort of different idea. One of them, Aaron David Miller, actually, when he wrote, they of course all wrote a book when they lost their jobs. In his book, he says, we acted as Israel's lawyer, to which some of us said, well, duh. But it wasn't ever said publicly. So when he says it, it's way more important than when I say it, right? Because I wasn't in that team. He was the head of that team. So that becomes a very important part of this. So when we talk about the role of the U.S., we have to look at what is our responsibility as people who live in this country, pay taxes in this country. Some of us are citizens of this country. And in that context, we have to look at what has been the price paid for this so-called peace process. And the price has been paid overwhelmingly by the Palestinians. There's a saying that's quite common that says, you know, the current situation is not sustainable, so the parties are going to have to change. Well, the problem is, If you're Israeli, the current situation is thoroughly sustainable. It can be painful on occasion. There have been loss of life. There have been terrorist attacks, illegal and terrible actions. But a very tiny number of people have been affected by that directly. If you look at the Palestinian side, that's where it's not sustainable. The UN has said that Gaza, the Gaza Strip, which has a population of just under 2 million people, more than half of whom are under the age of 15, will be uninhabitable in 2020. That's in a year and a half. Right now, the water in Gaza is 93% not drinkable, and the 7% that exists is almost undrinkable because it's been salinated. There's too much salt in the water. Why? Because they've never been able to rebuild the water treatment plant. Why? Because Israel doesn't allow the parts to be brought in. Why was it not working in the first place? Because Israel bombed it in Operation Cast Lead in 2008, 2009, and then again in 2012, and again in 2014. So this is what we're looking at. So when we now hear this idea of, we need a two-state solution, that's the only solution. The answer is, well, whatever you think about the two-state solution, and frankly, for those of us, I've been a critic of the two-state solution for a very long time, but it doesn't really matter what I think. I don't live there. I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't get to say how many states there are or what they should look like. What I have a responsibility to is what my government does with my tax dollars and in my name. And that's what I think we have to look at. It's not about states. States don't have rights. You know, this people always come up with this question, well, I'm going to show her, I'll ask her that question, she can't answer. Does Israel have the right to exist? And the answer is states don't have rights. People have rights. Israelis have rights. People have rights, but states don't. The U.S. didn't have the right to come and steal the land from the native people who once lived here. This was their land, not our land. And if we were talking 50 years after the first settlers had come, or 50 years after the country had been created, we might say that a not bad solution would be for all those people to have to move somewhere else, one part of the land only, or go back to where they came from. That wouldn't have been such a bad idea. Now, that's not realistic, and nobody is calling for that. And ironically, nobody is calling for that in Israel and Palestine either, that anybody has to leave, except for the Israelis are saying the Palestinians have to leave. And we're going to create conditions that give them no option, no opportunities. So for all of these years, this 25-year peace process, what everyone knew, right, was that there were four what they called final status issues that had to be resolved. So those were refugees, borders, settlements, and Jerusalem. Those were the four complicated issues that would have to be resolved before you could finally say that the conflict's over, right? So what are we looking at now? We're dealing with final status issues for sure. The Trump administration has gotten rid of one of them, taken Jerusalem off the agenda. That's his words. He says, we've taken Jerusalem off the table. Okay, and that's supposed to make things better? But apparently yes, because now the U.S. recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel only and has moved the embassy, as you all know, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So what does that say to Palestinians who have been told for 25 years by the United States government that whatever the flaws of the Oslo process, at the end of the day, you will have an independent state? And it will have some kind of a capital in Jerusalem. And some of the Palestinians said, you know what, we don't really think that's true. We think we're going to be stuck having our capital in some little dusty corner of someplace like Abu Dis, which is a little dusty village outside of Jerusalem, which is kind of like saying, if you live in New York, well, we're going to give you Newark, and we'll let you call it New York, which is fine, except you can say what you want, but Newark is not New York. I don't mean that as to disparage Newark. I happen to love Newark, but, you know, it's not New York. So this is what we're sort of facing at the moment. And in that context, we've now taken Jerusalem off the table. We've taken refugees off the table in perhaps the most cruel way, by defunding what keeps the refugees alive. 80% of the population of Gaza are refugees. They were made refugees in the 47-48 war. They were forced from their homes and never allowed to return, despite international law that says anyone after any war always has a right to go home, and the specific international law, known as UN Resolution 194, that says specifically Palestinians have the right to return to their homes and compensation for their losses. Not one or the other. It's not like somebody gets to say, oh, no, we're not going to let you go home, but we'll give you some money. This is the Trump view. That's not what it says. It says they have the right to return and compensation for their losses. So now all that's left is borders and settlements. And we know that can be dealt with by fiat. We know who's in charge of the negotiations. Jared Kushner. What's he known for? Well, he's donated thousands of dollars to the settlement project in the occupied territories. He's very proud of that. He thinks that makes him a better negotiator. So that's what we're now dealing with. That's the new plan. And now we have something even more. How many of you have heard, another test here, about the new Israeli law known as the nation-state law? Ooh, a lot of you. Good, you've done your homework. Excellent. The faculty should be very proud. I'm glad of that. It's gotten a lot of publicity, and it should. This is a new law. You know, Israel doesn't have a constitution. They have what they call basic laws. There's, I think, five of them, which together sort of amount to a constitution. They don't quite call it that, but it's sort of the same thing. It's like not just a law, it's the fundamentals of what the country is supposed to look like. So this law was passed, this law was passed as an amendment to the basic law. And what it says is that Israel is a state only for the Jews. It says explicitly the right of self-determination belongs solely to the Jewish people. The only legal language of the country will be Hebrew. Until now, officially, although it wasn't really recognized, but officially Arabic was an official language equal to Hebrew, no longer. And it says explicitly that this is designed to make Israel the state of the Jewish people. So it's like my state, although I don't live there, my parents never went there, my grandparents never went there, why do I get to have that be my state? This is a serious problem. In a certain way, it takes away the illusion of the Oslo two-state solution with swaps, which was never real, but was based on the idea that if nothing else, there would be something called a Palestinian state equal to an Israeli state, and Palestinians inside Israel would have some level of equality. Well, it turns out that you don't have equality either within Israel, where 20% of the population are Palestinian Arabs. Many of the Jews, of course, are Arabs as well. They're from Morocco, they're from Iraq, they're from other parts of the Middle East as well, Turkey and Iran and elsewhere. But they are Jews, and nationality in Israel is defined by religion. So there's no such thing as an Israeli nationality. The Israeli identity cards don't give you, they call for nationality, but it's not Israeli or something else. It's Jewish or Muslim or Christian. That's nationality. And part of the problem is Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, who are about three-quarters of that 20%, they have the right to vote. They have the right to run for the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. In that way, they are equal. But not all rights in Israel are determined by citizenship. There's these nationality rights that are designed to privilege Jews and to discriminate against Palestinians. So this new nation-state law creates a whole official new legal system, where you now have two legal systems for two different population groups within the same territory. And if you look at the language of the International Covenant against a particular crime, that's exactly the definition of it. And what is that crime? It's the crime of apartheid. And what we now find out is that it's no longer political suicide for mainstream, in many cases even officials, to describe Israeli practices as apartheid. Not because it looks like South Africa, it doesn't. doesn't look really anything like South Africa. But because it is in violation of the international covenant against the crime of apartheid. So you have the redefinition of refugees, to take refugees out of the equation. You have the Jerusalem issue being taken off the table. You have equality for Palestinians either inside Israel or in the West Bank, where you have the distinction between Palestinians who are indigenous there and Israeli settlements, 650,000 Israeli settlers who now live in the occupied territories, violating international law every morning just by getting out of bed. You have this huge contradiction. You have this huge contradiction that is called apartheid. I'll give you one example of it. If you look at it in the West Bank side of things, take two kids who live in the West Bank. They're both, say, 12 years old. And they've both been kind of naughty, and they've been throwing stones at a car, they've been throwing stones at a window, whatever. One of them, an Israeli kid who lives on a settlement, would be arrested the way our juvenile justice system is supposed to work. Often doesn't, particularly with kids of color, but it's supposed to work. The kid gets arrested, his parents are told why he's being arrested, he's taken to a juvenile court. With his parents being present, a lawyer is always present whenever he's questioned. The whole system is designed in the interest of the child. It's to help the child become a better person, stop doing this kind of thing. It's not designed to be punitive, right? It's designed the way a juvenile justice system should be. The other kid's a Palestinian kid whose family has lived in the neighboring village for 10, 15, 20 generations. And he's doing the same thing. What happens to him? Well, he gets identified by the soldiers that are patrolling. He doesn't get arrested right then. They arrest him at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is what UNICEF has determined is the usual way that Israeli soldiers arrest children, because it's more frightening. He's taken away from his home. His parents are not told where he's being taken. He's taken inside Israel, out of the West Bank, and again in violation of international law. Interrogated often in Hebrew, and for older kids, made to sign a confession written in Hebrew, which almost none of the kids speak or write or read well enough to even know what they're signing. There's no lawyer, and they are brought to court in a military justice system. Israel is the only country in the world that has a military juvenile detention system for children as young as 12. So you have two 12-year-olds doing the same thing in the same territory with the same government in charge and two entirely different systems affecting them. And the determination is based on religion, ethnicity, nationality, all the criteria of the UN covenants against racism. That's what Israel looks like today. And that's why Representative Betty McCollum from here in Minnesota, somebody you should be very proud of, said recently, "The world has a name for the form of government that is codified in the new nation-state law. It is called apartheid." And guess what? This guy didn't fall. She's running for re-election, and she's going to win by a landslide, because her district in St. Paul knows that she's a really good member of Congress. She defends her district, and they push her to support human rights everywhere, no exceptions. And that's what I think we have to be about as people in this country, whether we're citizens or not, whether we can vote or not. Those of us who can vote should be voting. People have been killed for the right to vote, and we have every obligation, those of us who can vote, to use that. This district is a pretty important one, I understand, and I hope all of you go out and vote. Students who may not have thought about going out to vote and bothering to register and stuff, do it. Register. I think Minnesota is a day of, you can do same-day registration. But don't wait. Do it ahead of time anyway, just in case. Vote. Vote. It's very important. So what are we looking at? This isn't as complicated as it has to be. It's not about how many states there are. That's for people who live there. Do they want one state, two states, three states? I don't know, five states, no states. That's not our business. Our business is to change our government's policy away from a policy that supports occupation, that pays $3.8 billion of our tax money every year directly to the Israeli military, who's doing this stuff like a juvenile detention system for children in the military. That's what we're paying for. You know, this is crazy. We see these incredible nonviolent protests in Gaza. It's now up to 205 people who have been killed so far in these weekly protests that began on March 30th. And it's extraordinary to think about. These are families, young people, old people, going out, approaching the fence that the Israelis have erected to surround Gaza, when they have been told over and over again that the Israelis have brought snipers to shoot them down if they march on their own land towards that fence. Thousands have been injured. Hundreds of young boys have lost limbs, arms and legs that had to be amputated, not because they had to be, but because the hospitals in Gaza don't have the equipment needed to do the real repair work, and the only option to avoid the child dying was to amputate their leg or their arm. And they're not being allowed out to go to hospitals in the West Bank, other Palestinian hospitals. This is what our support has made possible. There's an incredible quote from an Israeli general, General Fogel, from last May, when on that day of the same day that the U.S. opened its embassy in Jerusalem, you remember that, and he was talking about killing children, and he said, "Anyone who could be a future threat to the border of the State of Israel and its residents should pay a price for that violation." And the radio interviewer wasn't quite sure he heard it right, and he said, "So his punishment is death?" And the general immediately said, "Yes, his punishment is death for children." This is why people are coming out, because the difference between life and death right now in Gaza is not very much of a difference. So what does that mean for us? How do we go about changing? There is some good news, despite all of what I've said. The good news is that the discourse about this issue in the United States has changed dramatically. Dramatically. Now, the policy has not changed at all, except under this administration, it has gotten far worse. So I'm not making any claims that we've had the kind of success that we need as a movement that supports equality and Palestinian rights. But I am talking about one of the things that has to happen first. Our democracy in this country is badly, badly damaged. We know that public opinion does not determine what policy looks like. We know that most people in this country don't support threatening to send the military against a group of 5,000 desperate families marching north from Honduras. Most people in this country don't support that. But our opposition isn't yet enough to change that policy. But we can't change the policy without public opinion. So that's where there's some good news, where there's been a real discourse change. If you look at the last 10 years, I've been working on this issue way too long. But, you know, when I look back 30, 40 years ago when I started doing this work, the change seemed like it was never going to come. Forget about policy change, just changing public discourse. That was never going to change. And it did, slowly, slowly, step by step, incremental, tiny little gains. But if you look at the last 10 years, my God, it's been faster than ever before. You have books being published. President Carter's book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, with that incredible picture of the apartheid wall on the cover. President or not, ex-president or not, no publisher would have published that book 30 years ago or 20 years ago. But suddenly you could publish that book. The book on the Israeli lobby, which I don't like very much. I think the book is very problematic in a whole host of ways. But it broke a taboo that said you're not allowed to write a book about the Israeli lobby. You know, the fact when 60 members of Congress skipped the speech, when Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, came to Congress to address a joint session of Congress, made it look like an inauguration, a State of the Union address, the arrogance of it, when he brought his own people to fill out the seats and pointed to them the way presidents do at the State of the Union, and was doing it to convince Congress to vote against their president, to vote against the Iran nuclear deal. 60 members of Congress said, I'm not going to go. That's an outrage. Now, not all of those members of Congress were boycotting the speech because of their concerns about Palestinian rights. Some were. For many members of the Black Caucus, they were outraged at the racism with how Netanyahu treated President Obama. And that's a perfectly legitimate reason to boycott Netanyahu, too. So this was amazing. And there was a lot of fear on the Hill. What's going to happen? Are we going to lose our re-elections? Or is the sky going to fall? Well, the sky didn't fall. And not one of them lost re-election having anything to do with that action. So there's been these incredible changes. Congresswoman McCollum would never have said what she did absent this kind of a shift. And it's gone on every level. The change in the Jewish community is even more dramatic. When I was growing up, a Jewish kid in California, if you wanted to identify as a Jew, that was important to your family, your sense of identity, you spent time at your temple, all of that, it was all about Israel. God didn't really enter into the equation. It was about Israel and supporting Israel, absolutely uncritically. And it was a kind of left-wing thing. There was a lot of talk about socialism, the kibbutz movement. It was very exciting for young people in those days. And we never thought to ask, where did that land come from, where those socialist kibbutzim are? Who lived there before? Where are they now? We never asked those questions. We never asked those questions. But now, and if we wanted to engage organizationally, there were the groups like AIPAC and the Council of Presidents. That was it. When I was a camp counselor and all that stuff, it was with one view of Israel. Israel can do no wrong. We were as loyal to Israel as we were to our own country. That's not the case anymore. Now, the Jewish community is like any other community. It has a left, a right, and a center. It has organizations that fight with each other and that represent different positions all the time. My organization, Jewish Voice for Peace, has 250,000 online supporters and 40,000 members, paid members. We have a rabbinical council of, 25 or 30 rabbis around the country. You know, it's a whole different world for young Jews growing up with different choices. So all of that is different. The BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions campaign, a nonviolent campaign to bring economic pressure to bear on Israel to force an end to three very specific violations of international law. Nothing like that ever existed before. Nothing like that existed. And it's under incredible pressure. It's under incredible pressure because there's fear that young people, young students, it's why the students, the campus-based BDS campaigns are in the target far more than, say, the mainstream churches that have passed amazing resolutions calling for boycotting companies that are profiting from occupation. They're not being targeted because the students are more vulnerable. So all of this change is underway. And this is the important part. This is the part that we see a movement growing that deals with the question of equality and human rights as the basis for a settlement, for a solution, for ending the conflict, rather than ending the conflict on the basis of Israeli power. That's the big difference that we see now. So we're saying we need a U.S. position that's grounded in international law, human rights, and equality for all, not grounded in support for occupation, support for Israeli militarism, et cetera, which is what we have today. So that's our job. It's not our job to say how many states there should be. It's our job to say what our government does. We have to stop providing $3.8 billion a year in military aid. Israel is the 23rd wealthiest country in the world. Why are we sending them money at all, let alone directly to the military? Right? So that's the good news. And I think voting is a huge part of it, not because the position on Israel-Palestine is what determines what you vote for, but voting for people who also believe in human rights and equality for all becomes the basis on which voting really matters in this country. I want to just read you one last thing, and then I'm going to stop so we have time for questions and discussion. This was just a bit more of what Representative McCollum said. She was speaking along with Reverend William Barber. How many of you have heard of Reverend William Barber and the Poor People's Campaign? A lot of people. Another example. Here's somebody with very much a national presence right now, making the question of Palestinian rights and equality for all the centerpiece of a moral issue. So he also spoke at the National Convention of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, as did Representative McCollum. And this is one of the things she said. She said, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu are partners intent on destroying any future for the Palestinian people. There is no peace process. The U.S. is not an honest broker. There is no illusion of this White House even caring about Palestinians. The White House point person on the Middle East is Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. The U.S. ambassador to Israel is David Friedman, a bankruptcy lawyer by trade and a right-wing extremist by choice. Over the years, both Kushner and Friedman have invested financially in supporting and sustaining West Bank settlements, settlements that violate international law. So the two top American officials leading U.S. government policy on Israel-Palestine are not diplomats, but appear to be more like settlers, right-wing settlers themselves, who actively seek to expand Israel's control over Palestinian land, livelihoods, and future. It is appalling. That's a member of Congress who's running for re-election, knowing that she can say that without worrying about her base being left behind. And I'll give you one other example of it. The year 2010, the students among you may be too young to remember this, but the community people, you'll remember this. This was the year that Obama was being charged with throwing Israel under the bus, right? Netanyahu was coming and lecturing him, doing the finger-shaking thing, racist as could be. And that summer, there was a poll, a public opinion poll, a national poll, about a number of international issues, one of which was Israel-Palestine. And one of the questions said, Israelis are building settlements in many places. Which of the following two sentences best describes what you think about those settlements? So sentence number one says, the Israelis are building settlements for security and they have the right to build wherever they want. Sentence number two says, the Israelis are building settlements in in expropriated land. The settlements should be torn down and the land returned to its original owners. Now, in international law, that's precisely what should actually happen, but describing it that way is quite extreme, right? But it was done deliberately to see what would be the balance, what would people say. Among Democrats, 63% chose door number two. And used that extreme language, accepted that reality. At a moment when Obama was being accused of abandoning Israel, and everybody assumed that support for Israel is a given across the United States, it's become a partisan issue to a large degree, in a way that it never was. But it is now. But we now know, even though polls are only snapshots, that was a snapshot from 2010. Who knows how long it lasted? Maybe a week, maybe a year, maybe an hour. But for that moment, that was what happened. And that's what gives me hope. We make that hour into a week, into a year, into a decade. And we see there is hope that the current generation of Palestinian children will not have to grow up knowing that the U.S. is only the force that enables their occupier to continue. We can change it. We can change it by voting. We change it by protesting. We change it by demanding that our members of Congress stop doing what they're doing and do something different. That's what it's all about. Thank you.
You have been listening to Middle East scholar Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., speaking in Duluth, Minnesota. And we're out of time. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.